Hello and welcome to the Android Central Podcast. It is June 28th, 2019. I am Andrew Martinik and I am joined by these two fine gentlemen. I was going to say to my right and left, but you know, we're on Skype, so who knows? The first of which is Jerry Hildenbrand. How are you doing, man?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. And on my other side of this Skype window, I have Alex Dobie.
I'm doing just fine. Yeah, this is... We're in a bit of a heat wave at the moment in Europe, so you know, it's not so much of an AC podcast as a non-AC podcast because no one on this continent does air conditioning, but I'm just about holding out.
And I had to turn off my air conditioning so it's not too loud, so this is really is a non-AC.
Of course, yeah, you're in San Diego these days, so you can probably feel some of my pain.
I feel some of it, but I believe we are probably 15 degrees colder than what you guys are dealing with over there.
I've got my AC set at 74, and I have a drink with a little umbrella in it.
Well, I have a cold beer, but I already hate you just on the basis of AC, Jerry.
Please don't put an umbrella in your beer. That's all I want. We don't need to talk about the weather anymore, let's be honest. What we do need to talk about is some big technology news, not in the Android world per se, but I can bring the two together, don't worry. Johnny Ive, who'd been at Apple as their kind of lead design guru for 30 years, has left the company to go form a new design consulting firm. And everybody freaked out because they think that this is the what would you say, the death of Apple design or the future of good Apple design, because they think Johnny Ive made terrible devices throughout his entire tenure. But the interesting angle for people that like Android phones or anything non-Apple is that Johnny Ive is out there working and clearly still interested in electronics. He's actually taking on Apple as his first client, which is kind of a little weird. But I just wrote something quickly today to kind of bring up the thought that what would people think about a company like Samsung or Google or LG or whomever signing on Johnny Ive's design consultant firm to build whatever, the Galaxy S12 or the Google Pixel 5. Is this something that anybody would actually care about? I think that the people inside the companies probably would. Jerry, do you think that there's any sort of value to this as like a, you know, internally or externally to bring on such a huge name?
Well, there's always value to get somebody with, you know, a mind to design like Johnny Ive has. Love him or hate him, the man is good at what he does.
Yeah, you can't deny his accomplishments.
But why hire him when you can just wait till he's finished and copy it?
So that was my snark tweet response to the that post on AC today, asking whether you buy a Pixel 5 built designed by Johnny Ive, and I was like, well, he's already done the Pixel 4, hasn't he? So what do you want to do? I mean, it is interesting to think about him potentially being involved with phones besides the iPhone. I think realistically, that's never going to happen between whatever legal agreements he would have signed with Apple during his tenure there and whatever contracts are involved between his new firm and Apple now. Surely there's some kind of exclusivity in there. You're not going to have Johnny Ive and his new company working on the iPhone alongside a competing device. It's just not going to happen.
Yeah, I don't think that there'd be any sort of a situation where they're you'd be involved in two different devices at once, especially, you know, competing ones. And of course we know that that Johnny and everybody that he's involved with have the freedom to be able to be extremely picky about who their clients are. They're not going to be struggling for work, nor do they need the money per se. This really is kind of a passion project situation, and he clearly wants to do all kinds of other things rather than just making, you know, phones and laptops and all sorts of things like that. But it is just kind of an interesting idea that, you know, like you guys both intimated there's this trend that everybody watches Apple's design, you know, as like a leading tastemaker, you know, if not, you know, the best design. They have this draw to them that, yeah, when Apple releases something, everybody takes notice. And I think we're well beyond the you know, direct copy or, you know, direct influence kind of, you know, design permeating through the rest of the industry. But we are still looking at, you know, Apple setting the trends. And with Johnny being gone, it's not like Apple's just going to take a 180 and just all of a sudden start making triangle shaped phones or something. But everybody still does follow it.
Yeah. And Gruber had a really interesting post on Daring Fireball about this, saying that, you know, his design DNA is sort of permeates so much of Apple that you're going to be, you know, 5 years down the line before you start to see any difference from this guy's absence. You know, he's been involved with obviously the design of phones, but not just the phones themselves, but the design of the phone, the machines that make the phones, the precision engineering machines that make the devices that we eventually see. And then of course you have the fact that he designed the new Apple campus. So, you know, it's been a long time since perhaps on a day-to-day basis, he was focused on, okay, what is the next iPhone going to do? How's it going to look? To a large extent, that's pretty much a solved design problem. And you can maybe see him, you know, looking for fresh challenges, especially having designed, you know, having gone into architecture, having designed a building, a massive campus, having taken on that kind of challenge. Maybe, you know, even though he still has obviously that interest and that passion around gadgets and around electronics, you would imagine maybe this new company in areas outside of consumer gadgets, you know, are they going to be designing skyscrapers? Are they going to be designing public areas? You know, there's really no limit to what he can do in this new endeavor outside of Apple. And it's going to be interesting to see where he ends up.
Yeah, it is particularly interesting to consider what, you know, where he could go kind of tangentially to your typical phones, computers, you know, accessories kind of thing, because you do get the feeling that he was bored of that type of stuff, or maybe not bored, but just it wasn't a passion of his for a considerable amount of time.
And after 30 years, can you blame
him? And then, yeah, I've been here for 30 years and now you have me designing, you know, the AirPods 2 wireless charging case.
Well, he's always had a big passion for, you know, luxury automobiles. A lot of those are, you know, made close to where he hangs his hat. I would not be surprised to see him, you know, team up with someone at Aston Martin or Bentley or something like that.
Tesla?
And
although I don't know what kind of a, if he signed a non-compete with Apple, who knows? Because they supposedly have something in the works.
But, you know, he does a lot more than phones, I think is what we're all trying to say.
Yes, yeah.
And it is just also interesting if we want to just look at the Apple part of this as the one of the leading, you know, design tastemakers in the industry, that everybody that's currently at Apple, there's a little bit of a reshuffle happening, of course, with Johnny leaving, but all these people have just worked under Johnny for, you know, 5, 10, 15 years in many cases. This doesn't mean that Apple is just going to like change directions or things are going to be dramatically different. I do get the feeling that while there are lots of independent voices in there, they're independent voices that, you know, really cut their teeth coming through a very structured system in which Johnny was the decider. And, you know, if you want to continue and you want to be there and be part of his team, you're going to have to kind of work the way that he does and think the way that he does. So it's going to take a long time for that to get out of Apple.
The other interesting thing is that no one's really replacing him. And this is something that John Gruber was talking about as well in his piece that went up last night. There is no one taking over the old Johnny Ive role/job title.
Design czar, basically.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a point of concern for him because, you know, obviously, if you go back to when Johnny Ive first came on, it was very much in the, you know, but before the major revival of Apple in the late 90s. So, you know, the concern is that, okay, maybe Apple can coast for a while, but eventually are they going to start to suffer from not having as firm a hand on the design rudder if there is no, like, head of design at a company that really, you know, as much as it is valuable because of its brand power, is also incredibly valuable because of its design chops and its precision manufacturing chops.
No, because Apple is not going to hire someone who wants to buck the trend. They want a lead designer who wants to have a Johnny Ive approved look. That's Apple's DNA. You don't just walk away from that.
Go ahead there, Jerry.
Things are going to continue to, follow the same trend. They're going to make small changes, incremental changes. 5 years from now, the phone's going to look different than it does today, but it's still going to be in the same design style because it's successful and people love it.
Yeah, I wish I remembered who sent out their own snark tweet here that was really good. That they just said, I can't wait for the next iPhone to come out in 3.5 months and have people say, Johnny Ive would have never let this design come out. And they're going to be doing that for the next year and the next year and the next year. It's going to be the ultimate scapegoat, just like, Steve Jobs never would have let this happen kind of thing. And it's like, well, yeah, he kind of is in part letting it happen because he's so ingrained in all of these things and was looking years and years ahead. We often have way too short-sighted of a feel for how long these products take to come out.
And also, I think we kind of have a narrow feel for what Johnny Ive actually did/does at Apple. It's easy to look at him as the guy who designed the iPod, the guy who designed the iPhone. But he was also involved in the software. You know, he was involved, like I said, in the machines that made the machines. And he's, involved in the design of the campus, involved in the design of the computers and everything else. It's very reductive to just look at him as a guy who designs phones, because that, I think, in the end, was probably quite a small part of his job, especially given the fact that phone design now is basically a solved problem. We're rapidly approaching this point where the front is going to be all screen. The cameras are going to be built into the display. They're going to disappear when the screen's on, and it's going to be metal around the sides. It's going to be glass on the back because you need that antenna visibility for 5G. And that is going to be your phone design. And the only difference is going to be what color is the back and how do you arrange the cameras? And that's not a particularly interesting design challenge. And, of course, that is to say that, if you are the head of design at Apple, are you really focusing much on that on a day-to-day basis? Probably not.
Do you know one thing that is going to be different? Everyone's going to notice it and miss it a lot. Is that that sweet voice in the next iPhone's marketing videos? Alex, you should see if you can do it.
Yeah, Alex could do it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you just need a really soft white room. You need to shave your head and you need to get some trendy glasses.
I can do at least sort of 3/4 of those things, I think.
Well, we do have one device that we've been using. Well, Alex has been using that Johnny Ive would definitely not have released, and that is the Asus ZenFone 6.
But that's the best intro ever.
Despite
that, actually wasn't, wouldn't have released.
Yeah, that actually wasn't your headline.
For anything else we might want to talk about?
Yeah, that wasn't your headline. Your headline was the phone for selfie obsessionists and Android purists. And this device has actually been far more intriguing and interesting to people than I ever would have thought going into it. I mean, I remember when you first told me about it, I was like, okay, that's kind of cool, but it's an Asus phone. What's the deal there? But it turns out it's actually really interesting, especially for the money.
Yeah. So the first thing, like you said, is the money. This is a phone that basically is targeting that OnePlus 7 price point, not the 7 Pro,
not the Pro.
So it's the, $500 to $600-ish US dollar price point. And obviously you have the highest end chipset. You have a lot of power. You have a giant 5,000 mAh battery because they decided, okay, we're just going to go all in on capacity. We're not going to worry too much about fast charging. We've got Quick Charge 4. That's good enough. We'll go with a giant battery instead, and we'll fill out the chassis with that instead of worrying about having a smaller battery so that we can charge it more quickly. And the other major feature is you have this crazy flip camera. And
so bonkers.
It is, yeah. So it takes the approach of the OnePlus 7 Pro and kind of takes it to its logical conclusion. So you have a camera around the back that can also rotate fully to all the way around the front. So you have a regular camera, you have a wide-angle camera. You can actually rotate it not just to the back or the front, but anywhere in between. So if you want to get sort of level with a pet or something without spooking it, or you know, you just want to get sort of a unique angle looking up at clouds or skyscrapers or whatever. It's actually a really useful way to do that. You just swipe up on the shutter button and it kind of, you know, rotates smoothly through that arc. And arguably the more sort of sweeping change is what they've done with the software, because the software on Asus phones used to be pretty bad. It used to be all about, you know, these garish colors, you know, having the Zen UI that looked different, you know, all these features that had their own brand name, that had their own team behind them. Like, everyone was competing for attention, and it really did feel like the phone was just shouting at you in a lot of different ways. And now it's still Zen UI, it's Zen UI 6, but it's pretty much following a lot of the design tenets of OxygenOS. So you have stock Android and they build features on as makes sense. There's a, you know, big focus on performance, but also on keeping to that stock Android look and feel, to not making it look different for different sake. And where there have been design changes, making them in a way that makes sense. So having a one-handed mode, having it so that you have controls at the bottom of the screen, so it's easier to reach, things like that. And of course, gesture controls, and they have their own dock mode. They're promising fast updates to Q. They're really sort of turning it around in terms of where they were before. Obviously, they realized that software track wasn't working. And, you know, in addition to making a phone that actually, in terms of the specs and price and features, stands out, they're also doing a lot right in terms of the software.
Yeah, I'll get back to the camera point, because I really think that that's actually interesting, and the comparison to the OnePlus 7 Pro is neat. But to see Asus do what people have been pleading them to do the entire time that they've been making Zen UI is really great. And to have it actually come off in, like you said, a very similar way to OxygenOS, which all of the fans, all of the people that could be potentially buying this phone, you know, hold in probably the highest regard, even above Google's, is it's the perfect combination. And these are the types of customizations that, like I said, we've been asking for years and years and years. Just make the tweaks that make sense. Make little changes, have your custom settings or your camera app or the one-handed mode or just a couple little things here and there that make sense, because like we've found out, just shipping, you know, AOSP with some, you know, a couple of customizations is not a good experience. We do want tweaks. We just don't want you spending time on like your own calculator app and, you know, changing all the icons and the colors and everything for no real benefit. So it's just, it's amazing to me that they did it. It's also just amazing that it came together properly. And it sounds like the software is really good and performant and everything like that, which is, you know, not what you expect when they completely change course in one generation.
Yeah. And I think this change has been the result of a lot of sort of internal sort of soul searching and a lot of examination of where they've been coming from over the past few years, what's worked, what hasn't worked. You know, when I first went to see it back in April, which seems like forever ago now, but they were very upfront about the fact that there were a lot of sort of vigorous internal discussions about this. And a lot of, you know, there were people internally who were pushing very, very hard for this stock Android look and feel. And, you know, it seems like the reception to that has sort of justified the enthusiasm they had for it. Obviously, this is a $500 to $600-ish phone. It's not going to beat the higher priced phones in a lot of areas. Obviously, it doesn't have the best screen. It doesn't have, you know, super, super thin bezels, although, you know, obviously there's no notch because you have the flip camera. But in terms of the balance of features, performance, and of price, you know, certainly I would recommend giving this a look. If you think about getting a OnePlus 7, certainly I think the Zenfone 6 should be on your radar as well, as you're considering those two phones.
Yeah, so the last part there is I want to talk about the camera, because I think that, you know, there are very few gimmicks left, but also there are very few gimmicks that actually turn out to be a really good idea. That Asus did a really good job, I feel, of integrating this into the design. It's going to look funky, right? No matter what, when the thing is up, it's going to be weird, and watching it flip over is just a novelty. But the result is, in a device that's, like you said, $500 to $600, one of the things that typically is cut is you're not getting a great selfie camera. Just even look at the OnePlus 7 Pro, which has this pop-up camera. It's the same basic kind of garbage selfie camera with fixed focus, nothing interesting. In this case, it lets Asus just flip over what is not a great rear camera, but pretty good. And all of a sudden, that makes it one of the best selfie cameras because it's a massive sensor with 48 megapixels doing this pixel binning like every other camera out there. And all of a sudden, it's way better than almost any other selfie camera just by virtue of being a mediocre, you know, or a higher rear camera.
Yeah, I wouldn't even call it mediocre. It's the main sensor is pretty much the 7 Pro, OnePlus 7 Pro sensor without any of the gravy. So it's a slightly darker lens. There's no optical stabilization. And then you have of course, the ultra wide angle as well, which just, you know, gives you a much wider field of view, which of course is super useful in taking selfies. So you almost have this weird situation where compared to the rest of the competition, relatively the selfie performance is way stronger, and actually the regular rear-facing performance is comparatively weaker just because you have this sort of middle-of-the-road camera setup that is performing both duties. We've had a couple of software updates since this thing arrived with us in the middle of May. Camera has improved. I think there are still like a few issues around sort of over-brightening, over-sharpening. There's this HDR plus mode and then an HDR plus plus mode, which is sort of like an optimized daylight shooting mode, which like works okay, but it's very sort of situational. It doesn't exactly tell you that that's how you're supposed to use it. And then it has a night mode as well, which, to be blunt, isn't as good as the night mode in a lot of other higher priced phones. But it's certainly, you know, for as much of a dramatic change as this was from the Zenfone 5 Z last year, that everything works as well as it does, that the whole package is as compelling as it is impressive.
So, Jerry, as a noted notch-hating enthusiast, how do you feel about, you know, the added mechanical complexity of something like the flip-over camera or a pop-up camera or something like that as a way to try and solve this problem? I mean, we've seen the problem solved a million different ways, but I know that you're not necessarily a fan of adding in all this mechanical complexity either.
I love mechanical things, but mechanical things fail. I'm not saying this is bad and will fail. My look on the whole situation is, I wonder how much money was spent in the design and the engineering and everything else to gain, you know, 1.1% screen to, you know, screen to body ratio.
Sure.
I think, you know, I much prefer the way they did what's the ROG phone. It's got bezels enough to hold, not enough to take anything away. You get nice front-facing speakers, and there's no flippy thing to break if it's going to break.
They were actually, yeah, so they went into a lot of detail about how the flip camera was engineered, and they actually had, I forget the exact weight, but they had some sort of ridiculous level of weight hanging off the mechanism at their launch event. So they're pretty confident in the strength of the thing. They're, you know, custom materials and all the rest of this stuff.
Yeah, and I understand why they do it. They do it because we demand it so loud,
and it isn't just about regaining screen space. It's also about the extra functionality that in the camera that gives you, and also just about the marketing of it. You know, this is something unique that basically no one else has.
Provided that this is engineered to last the life of the phone, this is a much better designed for people than a punch hole in the screen or a notch.
I think it's spec'd to, it might even be the exact same number as the OnePlus 7 Pro's mechanical camera. So it's basically like five years of use until you potentially start to see issues.
Yeah, and it just generally, it looks like something that was actually designed and decided upon rather than the typical pop-up selfie camera, which is kind of like designing to meet, you know, your maximum size requirements and that's about it. And, you know, when you, it seems like an elegant solution in the way that a lot of these other pop-up and slide-up and move-around things aren't necessarily, you know, as much.
And Jerry, you mentioned the ORG phone there. Interesting to sort of look at the way the Asus phone line is now. So the Zenfone used to be just the flagship, the one at the top.
Right.
And that's kind of changed this year. It kind of changed last year as well, but it's definitely changed this year. We have it on the record from them. They told us back in April on the record, there will be another ROG phone. So, right. You know, that'll be coming at some point. But really, the Zenfone now is sort of their mid-tier flagship. And where they want to go all out crazy flagship, that's going to be the ROG phone, which kind of mirrors what they're doing with the PC side of the business too.
Right. I mean, yeah, that makes sense as a company decision. You put your recognized name on your high-end product.
This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Roan. It's a premier men's performance lifestyle brand. Now, what does that mean? It means they make clothes, but they don't just make any random clothes. They make great, high-quality clothes that kind of bridge the gap between performance clothing and, you know, something nicer that you would wear to work. And that's really important. If you have to, you know, dress a certain way, you know, you have to be business casual per se, or, you know, maybe full on business at work sometimes, you're going to want to look at Roan. And you can check out all of their stuff at roan.com. That's R-H-O-N-E.com. So when you go there and you look at Roan clothing, you're going to say, okay, this looks like the type of stuff that I normally would wear to work. But when you look at their commuter collection, and the name of the collection really makes sense when you think about it, you'll start to see that this is different than everything else that you're wearing right now. Roan's commuter collection brings a lot of the kind of fabrics and styling and just smart thinking around, you know, workout or gym clothing, athletic wear, and brings it into styles and looks that make sense in an office environment, in a more professional setting. And so they have pants and polos, shorts and shirts that are lightweight, they're comfortable, they're wrinkle-free, and the commuter collection is good for all sorts of weather because it's breathable and sweat wicking, and it makes sense both in the workplace and, you know, maybe you want to, you know, look a little smarter out at a weekend barbecue or, you know, after work when you meet up with your coworkers. These clothes go with you from the moment you walk out of the door, you take your commute, your train, your walk, whatever, and you get to the office. They'll take you all the way through the day and into the afternoon as well. Now, I've been wearing some Roan clothes and, you know, you may know from following us on Android Central, we don't commute. But you know what? I like to look my best whenever I leave the house, whether I'm commuting, quote unquote, to a coffee shop or doing some of those weekend activities. I like to have something that is comfortable and easy to wear. It doesn't feel uptight. And on the other hand, it looks great still. So if that's what you want in your clothing, and believe me, you do, especially after you wear some of the commuter collection, you need to go to roan.com/ACP. Again, that's roan.com/ACP for AC Podcast. And what are you going to get for that? Well, you're going to be helping out the Android Central podcast, of course. But what's important to you is you're getting 20% off of your first order. Now that's a pretty big deal, especially when you go check out Roan and you're going to be wanting to pick up more than just a couple of things. Believe me, you're not just going to buy one shirt and walk away. You're going to check out everything. And they don't just have the commuter collection. They also have, you know, more casual shirts, tank tops. I've got a great beach poncho hoodie that I'm really loving. Swimwear, they've got everything. So go to roan.com/ACP. Take 20% off your order, and you're really going to enjoy Roan. Okay, let's get back into it. Let's step away from hardware and go straight into the software world. And we are just going to plumb the depths of Alex's knowledge of all things Huawei in this second segment. So sorry, you're coming off a cold a little bit, I know, but we're, you know, we're just going to ask you to talk the rest of the episode. Jerry and I are going to just mute ourselves. Well,
that's not fine. Really. It's only almost like 100 degrees in here. That's good.
Yeah,
Johnny, no, I wouldn't complain if it was 100 degrees. Get with it, Alex.
As long as he was in his white room.
In his white room. You don't know the temperature in there.
They've designed the quietest air conditioning system. No. So you had this very interesting analysis of the Huawei software update promise. Huawei really went on the offensive a bit in the last couple weeks and really tried to do the whole, which never looks good, going on the offensive and saying, everything you're hearing is wrong. Take it from us. We promise that XYZ. But Huawei came out and they say, you know, we're going to update, you know, XYZ phones to Android Q guaranteed. We're going to make sure that this happens. Like, you have our word. And Alex and Jerry just immediately started thinking about what are the ways that this could actually happen. There are technological hurdles. There are, of course, law enforcement hurdles, but how is Huawei going to make Android Q happen for all these devices, Alex? And then what does that mean also going forward? Because sure, they could theoretically, we know there are some workarounds for Q, but what about beyond that and for new devices?
So take a bit of a step back first. So the thing that went out last week was a Huawei Answers website that went up, which on one hand addressed a lot of sort of common sense things. You know, obviously Google Play isn't going to disappear from your devices overnight. You know, you can still use WhatsApp or whatever, or Facebook and all this other stuff on your Huawei phone. If you factory reset it, Android isn't going to disappear. That was one of the points that they addressed, which might sound funny to us, but, you know, to a normal person who isn't immersed in this stuff every day, you know, a valid concern. One of the other things they mentioned was that they will continue to provide software and security updates, and that something like, I think, 17 phones will get Android Q. And actually, the Mate 20 Pro has already been approved for Q when that eventually rolls out. And given Huawei's current predicament, it is a little bit difficult to see how they can do that. We sent emails out. They haven't been able to give us a response yet. I'll be talking to them some more in person next week, so we'll see what they say. But, I mean, the problems are partly legal and partly technical. So the legal problem, obviously, is that Huawei is on the US's entity list. Right now, it has this waiver, which means it's able to do business with Google and certain other companies. It's able to work with certain US technology in order to maintain its current devices. The definition of a current device is kind of super up in the air. Whether it's something that's on sale or whether it's something that's in development and just physically exists, that's another major question mark, because if it's the latter, then who knows whether the Mate 30 is included or not? Who knows whether we'll actually be able to launch that phone? But you know, without getting too much into the weeds on that, after August 19th this year, that waiver expires. And at that point, if they're still on the US's entity list, if they're still on that blacklist, they can't do business with any US company. They can't use anything that's classed as US technology, which is, you know, any technology which has more than a trivial amount of US technology. And I think the number is something like 25%, which, again, is very, very hard to quantify when you're talking about both hardware and software. So What Huawei has done is it has said that, okay, in any eventuality, we are still going to upgrade devices to Q, and we are still going to provide security updates to our devices. And it's very hard to see if they're still, you know, if they're still on the blacklist, if that expires after August, how they do that. Okay, probably we're looking at Android Q landing sometime in August. Even if it's at the end of August, you know, the device manufacturers would have already had Q, the final version of Q, for at least a month before that. So they could probably squeak through the final version of Q for all these devices before then, get it certified, push it out super quick. That would be fine. But then what happens when it comes around to September, October, and you have new security patches rolling out? The way it works for Google Android devices with Google's mobile services, is that any new update needs to go through Google's approval process. You have something called the CTS, the Compatibility Testing Suite. That stuff is open source, which means manufacturers can run those tests themselves to verify that their code passes. But before it gets pushed out to phones, it needs to go to Google, and it needs to be given their rubber stamp, and the signature needs to be uploaded to a Google server, because that's how it works. That's how you can guarantee that the firmware is secure for things like Google Pay, for things like banking apps, sensitive DRM-enabled apps as well. So it follows that if Google can't use any US technology, for one, that kind of means they can't even use open-source Android if you take a strict reading of that. I mean, Ars Technica had a very good write-up of that this week from somebody who's a lawyer very familiar with US export law and the enforcement of bans like this, saying that actually it's way more far-reaching than most people appreciate. But just in terms of the mechanics of pushing out an Android update, if you can't deal with Google, if you can't get that signature onto a Google server because you're not allowed to work with Google, then you can't push out an update. You either don't update your devices, which is bad, or you push out an uncertified update, which from looking at some of the distribution agreements that Google has signed with manufacturers in the past, some of those have leaked out. Some of them have been pushed out publicly, like Motorola's when the acquisition happened. The ability to have certified firmware goes hand in hand with passing CTS. So you can't have one without the other. The other side of that is if you push out an uncertified update, you break up a whole bunch of stuff. You break Google Pay on devices. Okay, probably you violate your contract with Google, but you break a ton of stuff on your customers' devices, which is also really bad. And the question that I put to Huawei that they haven't been able to answer yet is, given all this stuff that is going on that we know to be true, the legal and technical hurdles, you guys have promised to update your devices. How the hell are you going to do it? And they haven't been able to give us an answer yet. And it'll be very interesting to see what that answer is. Obviously, they can still work with Google until the 19th. So is the answer that, the whole certification process gets uprooted so Huawei can just do what it wants? Or is it something else? Or is there some kind of deal in the works? There are a lot of unknowns right now, and it's almost Huawei saying something and promising to push those updates out is more interesting than them saying nothing. But it's really, I have no idea how they're going to be able to fulfill this promise.
Jerry, do you have any confidence that technologically they can find a way to gracefully handle this if the proverbial stuff hits the fan?
Their confidence that they can do it makes me believe that there's something that nobody wants to talk about yet being worked on. You don't. You say no comment if it's something that you can't do. But if you're sure you can do it, you get out in front of everybody and say, oh, yeah, we're going to do it. No problem. Don't worry about it.
Yeah. And the line that I got wasn't no comment. The line was that answers are coming, basically.
Yeah. So I'm pretty sure that, Google and Huawei have something in mind should they not be able to convince Washington that we need an extension or something.
And look, there are a lot of very smart people on both sides. It doesn't, right. Shouldn't surprise you that they would have some kind of fallback position.
Yeah, it very much feels like there's something much more serious and well locked in at play here than just saying, we assume that our exclusionary period to work with these companies is just going to be extended by another 3 months when we, get to early August. Like they wouldn't be able to make these types of statements based on that information only.
This Android isn't built in a bubble. Even Google certification isn't built in a bubble. Whatever they might be thinking about doing, you have other OEMs participating, trying to make sure it's, number one, going to work with their devices. And by other OEMs, of course, I mean Samsung. Nothing gets done to Android without it being good for Samsung. This may turn out to be good for the entire Android ecosystem as a whole.
Elaborate on that. What do you? I mean, just because they can find a way to do this in different ways?
Right. If they find a way to do it better, more streamlined, one thing that all phone enthusiasts complain about is the speed of which they get updates. If they can find a way to streamline that process, that's good for everyone.
Yeah, it does kind of also get back to this question that we have, who knows, every year, every 2 years when these big Android updates come out, that how much control of Android should Google have, realistically from a security standpoint or just, logistically from trying to get all these updates out. I mean, Alex made the great point there that there is far more Google involvement in the entire stack, the entire process of this than even, you know, Google tries to argue against the fact that it's that ingrained, you know, especially when it's trying to fend off regulation and fines from the EU. But realistically here, this is a perfect example, and this is perfect fodder for all those regulators to point out that if you take out Google from any part of the equation, it's not just an all or nothing thing. You pull out Google from any part of it, and the house of cards kind of falls down.
Yeah, it's the two are slightly different, I think. I mean, on the one hand, you know, Google certainly has control, and the fact that you can't push out an update without, you know, this intimate Google involvement probably does speak to the power that Google has over every single Android device. It's, you know, it's a, you know, if this current Huawei situation shows that, okay, they can't work with Google, that means they have difficulty updating their phones, and there's this massive upheaval. On the other hand, it's very much a kind of soft power. It isn't a direct, you know, telling you what you can and can't put on your phone. That's part of the mobile application distribution agreement, but it isn't necessarily, you know, Google looking through with a tooth comb every single update that goes out and saying, no, you can't have this, because that goes into the agreement that's eventually, you know, signed originally when someone gets on board with Android, or, you know, when you have a new device going out. So it's a little bit different, but I get the point you're making there.
Yeah, that's something that we probably don't stress enough. This all only applies if you want to use Google's closed software services. The whole thing is designed to make sure that every app in the Play Store works on your phone.
Right. It's not like there's no benefit to this arrangement. It helps a lot of things work, a lot of things that we take for granted in terms of compatibility and devices working relatively similarly. But this is just a good example. Whether it's accurate, fully accurate or not, it is going to be an example that in the future regulators will point to and say, well, look at, you know, what happened with all this.
Sure.
Now, whether that happened, you know, or the context in which that happens is going to vary dramatically based on how long this ban stays in place. If it ends up having continued material consequences for Huawei and other manufacturers, that's going to obviously paint a dramatically different picture. And that's why it's not surprising at all that Google would try to its, you know, fullest abilities and, you know, the extent possible to make this work somehow for Huawei, because Google doesn't want to be in the situation of losing this massive partner selling certified Android devices either. And Google is obviously being put in just as difficult of a position because it has to walk this legal line of what it can and can't do. Now, my question for you guys is, what, so full on doomsday scenario where, you know, Huawei is legitimately cut out from dealing with Google, what does it do? It has to just cut ties, you know, devices that are out there right now, they are what they are, like, okay. And going forward, I mean, I would just, what do they do?
I think
especially,
I think it depends on where the line is drawn and what happens with the Mate 30 this year. Supposedly there were reports, I think in Bloomberg, that the next Mate device is just going to sort of squeak in as going to, you know, it was in development before the ban hit. So, you know, through legal wrangling, it's going to be able to make it out on sale, and through whatever shenanigans are currently going on, it'll be able to be updated. Big question is what happens with the next P series phone next year. Because if they are, you know, if nothing changes between now and then, you're in a situation where potentially Huawei has to push out this, its own proprietary OS. In Chinese, it's Hongmong. There's supposedly going to be some other kind of brand that's used outside of China. But
sure,
potentially
so.
they're pushing this out with very little in terms of app ecosystem. Supposedly there'll be an Android runtime. But, you know, if they're going from, if you have a bunch of P10 or P20 owners updating to this and expecting a comparable experience, it's going to have a very negative impact on how much of that mark, how many of those upgraders you're going to be able to keep in your Huawei ecosystem. The other side of that is just Huawei trying to build its own platform. is going to be extremely difficult just for the reasons of the ban that's currently in place. And, you know, again, the Ars Technica article that came out this week was saying that actually, you know, US companies doing business with Huawei is bigger than, you know, Google or, you know, ARM or any, you know, ARM dealing in US technology and therefore not being able to deal with Huawei. Also, you have big US app developers. You have, you know, Twitter, Facebook, mm-hmm. you know, Instagram, WhatsApp, Google. If they're US companies, they're not allowed to deal with anyone on the entity list. That means that none of those apps are going to be on Huawei's platform when that launches. And
that
I think
that is an interesting point. I mean, we've looked at you know, Amazon Fire OS, you know, for example, having this separate ecosystem. It's like, okay, well, yeah, if they really want to do it and they want to pay off a ton of people, they can get the app developers.
And that's Amazon with all its resources and with the ability to trade with anyone it wants, and they still couldn't do it. So there are other issues beyond that of, okay, what is going into this Huawei phone that is more than 25% US technology? And it's a huge legal headache. And almost if it does come to that, I think eventually we look at just this gradual decline of their phone business to the point where in 3 years' time, eventually it's like we saw with HTC. They get cut back and cut back and cut back, and it's death by a thousand cuts, and they are limited to their home market, and that is just the end of it. That's the only real endpoint, unless there's some movement from the US side.
I don't think it's that bad. It's not good. It's not good, but there's HTML5 apps. That's, you know, the piece at Ars Technica didn't even speak about that. That fixes Twitter. There are lots of ways that customers could be served the things they want, but none of these ways are what they're used
to. They're ugly. They're right. Ugly, hacky ways that are inherently inferior to what Samsung and Apple and everyone else.
Right. That's the problem for every consumer in the West is we're used to smartphones working a certain way and providing us with, you know, what we want in a way that's convenient for us. That's what they can't do. They can't keep the convenience or offer the same level of quality.
Yeah, and Huawei already grew so much of its market share in, you know, non-US countries by offering something that's similar-ish to what they have, really well-made and dramatically cheaper. And that was basically the model, and it preyed on the fact that people are fickle and they're just going to, they're happy to switch if something comes along that's basically the same or better and dramatically cheaper. And they're going to do the exact same thing away from Huawei if Huawei tries to come out and say, oh yeah, well, it's still good and cheap, but also it's works entirely different and it doesn't have the apps, or, you know, it's this weird thing. People, you know, they don't have that brand loyalty there. A dramatic amount of Huawei's market share just comes from convenience and price. So they're not going to be able to take the P30 name and, you know, parlay that into a P40 announcement that's going to be super popular, even though it's all completely different on the software side.
I would slightly disagree with that. I think they're at the cusp of developing that. And the difference has been over the past couple of years where, compared to any other device that's on sale in Europe, Huawei devices have routinely outperformed them in terms of battery life. They've routinely outperformed them in terms of camera quality. You see what they're doing with the camera on the P30. You know, pretty much no one else can match what they're doing in low light. There's only, you know, really one other brand that is approaching what they can do in terms of the zoom camera. So I think a lot of people in Europe in particular are starting to associate a Huawei phone with the best camera and the best battery life. And if anything, then the current situation is probably an advantage for Oppo, which, you know, is competitive with Huawei in China, but also has a lot of the same features of the P30 and is spending a lot of money right now to get into Western Europe, to get into the UK. So almost it sort of hit them at this point where they're just about to sort of all their efforts around Leica and all their efforts around promoting the battery and the design and everything, all that's just starting to pay off in the past year or two, the past couple of cycles. And now they have this, potentially the hammer coming down on them.
It's interesting that you mentioned Oppo there, because Daniel and I discussed this on the last episode, because as he's been traveling around Eastern Europe and now into Turkey, that Oppo is huge. They're pushing super, super, super hard. They're basically pulling a Huawei from a couple of years ago in their European expansion. And the very interesting angle to all of this is that Oppo is also a Chinese company and also deals with US companies for many or all of the same components and software that Huawei does. And you have to wonder what the discussions look like inside of Oppo right now.
I'm sure that they also have board members who are officially tied with the Chinese government.
I mean, every Chinese... I mean, yeah. Look, I mean, that's just the nature of China. You know,
this is just another Huawei.
Every, you know, as is the case in the West, you have people who are members of a political party. Just turns out in China, there is only one political party. So, I mean, the difference with Oppo, I think, and how that relates to the phone business and, you know, any potential, you know, dealings in the future. A lot of people like to say, oh, you know, eventually if OnePlus gets too big, it's going to be SmackDown, or, you know, if Oppo does the same, then eventually they're going to have some kind of ban. The difference with Huawei is infrastructure. You know, none of the current controversy around mm-hmm. Huawei really has much to do with phones. You know, the current ban isn't in place because the US administration is worried about Huawei spying on you on your Huawei phone. It's worried about Huawei-made infrastructure that they can't check up on adequately, making its way into the networks of the US and of key US allies. There is a huge knock-on effect in phones, but the phones are not the target. So if you just have a phone business like Oppo does, or like OnePlus does, or, you know, like anything under that, you know, BKK umbrella does, you're pretty much fine, because the US doesn't care about you selling phones. The US cares about potentially infrastructure that can't be trusted making its way into key positions in the US and in its allies.
And that's the most unfortunate part about this whole thing, and something that Huawei just can't, I mean, it can't fight that angle. It's like it's the same, you know, overall conglomerate. I mean, Samsung or LG would have the exact same, or, you know, would have the exact same problems if, you know, as being part of a larger conglomerate that does all of these different things, they just get kind of screwed over by it. And that's just, I mean, in this case, it's Oppo's market to gain, but it really points out just how rough Huawei is getting this on the consumer electronics side.
I hate to be the harbinger of doom here. This is the beginning of apocalypse. If the U.S. goes up against China as a whole in tech, we are screwed. The U.S. consumers are screwed. That's not a good thing.
Yeah, not just because of you. I think it's a good point. It's not just because of the Huawei situation. It's seeing how this is playing out right now, and what if you applied that to, you know, XYZ company all the way down the line from different countries or something like that. Those knock-on effects from multiple countries and companies being involved in that, and of course, you know, feeding back to all of the other companies that are based in the U.S. that are supplying these, like these foreign companies. Of course, losing Huawei is going to be, as a business partner, as a client for all of these U.S. companies, is a problem. But it's just, you know, it's a surmountable problem. That's not the case if they're also losing, you know, 90% of their other top 10 clients because, you know, these bans go into effect on all sorts of other companies.
It goes broader than that. You can't brush your teeth in the morning without using toothpaste that was built in an assembly line that the electronics are built of the majority of the parts are Chinese. Those parts go bad daily and need to be replaced. You jack the price up 50%, your toothpaste is now $5 a tube instead of $3.
All of which is why the most likely outcome to this, I still think, is some kind of deal, some kind of agreement. It's going to be something that enables Huawei to keep its consumer business growing. It's going to be something that keeps the network infrastructure business outside of, you know, completely outside of the US and perhaps outside of other Five Eyes countries as well. Because that, you know, that's the real point of it.
Could Huawei spit off, could Huawei just dump all the assets into Honor and have it be a completely separate company and just build phones?
Maybe.
Because,
maybe,
you know,
I mean,
that could possibly
maybe
be
if
solution.
They had proactively done that
yeah,
a couple
I mean, if
of years
they,
ago.
If they do it now, then the new company just gets added to the entity list, you know, it's
maybe that could be terms of an agreement that they split the you know, the infrastructure part off and the Huawei brand is able to be sold in the United States. I don't know. I'm not a politician, but if we're only worried about, you know, we have a legitimate concern that there's a possibility we don't want their equipment to run our telecommunications networks, that could be isolated, I would think, from the rest of their consumer electronics division.
It's possible, but I think the end result wouldn't be particularly different from just Huawei CBG, the consumer business group, being able to go about doing its thing while the while restrictions are still placed on the network infrastructure side of things. You can split it out into its own company and change the brand. Yeah, you can split it out into its own company and change the brand, but nothing really changes, you know.
But what changes is it makes it look like we won, and that's important for American politicians to win.
I mean, it's important for Chinese politicians as well.
Sure. That's why we're playing political chicken until the last day of the August agreement.
Yeah, that's the question is who, you know, goes more flexible to try and make it look like they won without the other person losing, and does the proper amount of hand waving to let things just kind of go back to the way they were. That's basically what it's going to, that's what it's going to have to work out to. Sure, there's probably going to be concessions going back and forth, and whether I don't think that's ever going to reach, you know, the necessary concessions are not going to reach the level where Huawei is going to be asked to spin off, you know, different groups or whatever, because I think even U.S. politicians are not dumb enough to think that that actually means anything. It's all about the symbolism of it, of course, but even still, it's like that's a big hassle when they could just get some kind of other real concessions that would actually do something and, you know, just happily just let the thing go.
But we've already, I mean, we've already enacted laws that make it so we can't use Huawei equipment. You know, AT&T was stopped. This was unnecessary. You already can't use...
I mean... Logically speaking, yeah, except, you know, as a bargaining chip, you know.
Right. This is all political, which is why I think,
you know, that the most likely outcome is this is being used as leverage, like, you know, like I said a month ago, and eventually it'll go back to a solution where, you know, of course, the, you know, Huawei can't get into any U.S. network, so the concerns about the network business being, you know, or the business as a whole being cahoots with the Chinese Communist Party, you know, there are no worries there about that being entangled in U.S. networks, but the consumer business group can continue going on operating, but probably outside the U.S. Yeah, that's the most likely endpoint, and, you know, we'll see where we are in a couple of months.
And Alex, I'm going to give you, since you have done so much talking today already, I'm going to give you the choice of whether you want to really go down the rabbit hole of talking about EMUI 10, or if you would prefer to get your get yourself out of that sauna that you were calling a podcast studio today.
So this is going to seem like a bit of a cop out, but we obviously already have a hands-on feature up on EMUI 10. Not a whole lot to see there just yet. I'll talk a little bit about it since you mentioned it, but it's some minor visual changes. It's the Android Q stuff you will expect. It's a little bit of a radically redesigned camera app, and not a whole lot else to see right now, which maybe points to a little bit more of a leaner upgrade this time around. Maybe if they're looking at launching it sooner than you might expect just to get in behind that ban, that might be a possibility.
Yeah, definitely.
But they're not sort of... Based on what we're seeing in this early leaked version, things may change, you know, especially as we have the Mate 30 coming up later. Not a whole lot of radical changes just yet, but, you know, we'll have to wait and see. My argument was a few months back that we're sort of due another major revision of EMUI, because it's been, I think it'll be about 3 years since the last major change that we got to the visuals of this thing. A lot of people have changed jobs since then. A lot of designers have moved on. But obviously Huawei has other issues that it's dealing with now in terms of its software. So maybe we won't see that this year. It's a minor upgrade. It has all the good stuff that you know from Q. All the basic, you know, tenets of EMUI is still there. None of the few remaining annoyances, like the way it handles notifications, have really been addressed. But
yeah, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, that's the state of it right now. If you want to see how it looks, we have a video up on youtube.com/AndroidCentral right now.
That is the place to go. Like and subscribe, fam. I'm going to leave it
various
with
buttons.
I'm going to leave it with this poignant piece of analysis, calling it right now that Johnny Ive is going to help design EMUI 11, and then you can all complain to him.
Johnny Ive is gonna design a way around the current U.S. blacklist. It's going to be beautiful.
Wow.
And Alex is going to fly to Shenzhen and do the promo videos.
The heat has gotten to our heads. It is time to call this one an episode. Alex, where can they find all of your hot takes in temperature, mostly?
Well, you can find my hot takes in video form at youtube.com/AndroidCentral and in written form at AndroidCentral.com. You can find me on all the social things, Instagram, Twitter, whatnot, at whatever the URL is, /AlexDobie, at AlexDobie on all the things.
Bingo. How about you, Jerry? Where can they find you ranting about various geopolitical situations?
Nowhere. I'm smarter than that. But you can see what I have to think about Android on my Twitter. Maybe sometimes. It's at GBHIL. But the best spot to talk to me is yell at me in the comments of one of my articles.
Okay. Well, it's that easy. Just go to Android Central, find Jerry's column on Saturdays, Android and Chill, and just jump in the comments. You'll be right there. You're ready to take the punches.
I read them all and respond when I have to.
Wonderful. Well, you can not find me in Jerry's article comments, but you can find me on Twitter at Andrew Martinik, MARTONIK. And that's really the best place to come to read my hot takes and complain to me. I will also be all over Android Central as usual. And final programming note, Daniel Bader, happy birthday.
Yes.
Hope you're enjoying your last couple days in Turkey with your family and getting older by the minute, just like all of us. But it's okay. It's all right.
Happy birthday,
Mr.
President.
He'll be coming back next week. I will be out. But he'll be leading this clown car down some sort of road. Everybody can wish him a happy birthday on Twitter. He is at Journey Dan. All right, folks, let's wrap it up. Let's get the air conditioning turned back on. Sorry, Alex, open the window or something like that. And we will see you guys next time. Bye-bye.
Adios.
Catch you later.